Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Heathen Hour. As always, I am the good host, Shannon Q. The other host, Godless Cranium, is checking to make sure everything is going well in the background. And we have two very special guests tonight. We have Megan and Josh from Digital Hammurabi, which is one of my favorite channels. Aww. The link to their channel is in the description. Please click it and subscribe. They just hit 1,000, and that's not nearly enough because they are astounding, as you're about to find out. So I'll let them introduce themselves as well. So Megan and Josh, why don't you tell everybody about your channel and who you are?
Sure. Well, I'm Megan. This is obviously Josh, given that he's the one of us who isn't me. we are Assyriologists, which means we've spent far, far, far too long in school studying the languages and culture of ancient Iraq. Josh specializes in Hebrew and Sumerian, also has extensive training in New Testament Greek and Akkadian. I can do Hebrew, Greek, and Akkadian, but prefer not to unless pressed. And our video is kind of like a educational public outreach thing because there is so little accessible information about Mesopotamia available unless you like subscribe to an academic journal, and really no one wants to do that. So we're trying to kind of fill the need and bring people interesting information without boring them or taking all of their money. And having said that, if you want to give us your money, I'm down with that.
There's ways that you can do that as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think one of the nice things about what we do, and we haven't been doing it for terribly long, I have a lot of biblical training. So, you know, I went to seminary. I was a pastor for 7 years. I taught seminary. I taught the Hebrew cycle at seminary. And taught some biblical Greek, but and I think one of the things that I've noticed coming onto YouTube, having been here for what, 5 or 6 months or something, is that there's a lot of misinformation out there, but there are so many people that want to work with the biblical texts, and it's difficult because you know, you watch debates or you watch some of these podcasts or whatever you do with podcasts, I guess you listen to them anyway. And people will make assertions about the Hebrew says this, or the, you know, the Greek says this, or this, you know, Sumerian or Akkadian literary text talks about this. And we say, well, that's just not the case. But there's nobody there to really step in and say, well, actually here's how you understand that passage in Genesis 1. And so I feel like that's sort of the need that we fill, which is fun.
It is fun,
and it's a way that we can utilize our weird training.
Yeah. If there was one piece of misinformation that you found on YouTube, what would it be? Like, if there is one that's the most prevalent,
aliens. That's my own personal hobby horse. Ancient aliens. No. Just no. Yeah. And Sigfin, by the way, did not read Sumerian. All of his translations are incorrect or made up, or possibly, you know, a combination of both.
I mean, if he did, he hides it very, very well.
Yes, he's really trying to make sure you know he didn't read it.
And I would say, for me, what I've come across is misunderstanding of texts like Genesis 1, Genesis 2. Because
what specifically?
I hear young earth creationists, for example, all the time talking about, even people that aren't young earth creationists, people that people that believe that Genesis 1 is some sort of a historic or a scientific account of how God created the world, unfortunately, it's not understanding ancient genre. You know, there are genres that existed in the ancient world that we don't have today. And in the same way that we wouldn't look at a poem, like we wouldn't look at the Psalms, and when it says day and night, my tears have been my food, we wouldn't, you know, write some sort of ancient dietary documentary on people consuming, you know, their tears in order to survive. No, we'd understand that as
poetry. I'm doing that right now. What are you
talking? Well, we obviously can't speak for you.
Right.
But
the thing is, since we have poetry today, we recognize that genre. But because Genesis 1 is a type of cosmological genre that we don't have today, people look at it and think, well, this is written like what we would consider history. or science. And so they try to, you know, fit either a young Earth creationist model into it, or even an old Earth creationist model, like somebody like Hugh Ross, you know, tries to make the text talk about natural evolutionary history. It's just not necessary, and it's not necessary, it's just wrong. It's not understanding the genre of
Genesis. if I'm reading the book of Genesis, how should I be reading it? Like
you know, this is a book that is a text that was written probably in the 6th century, you know, BCE. It's written to try to explain where ancient Israel came from, right? They're sitting in the Babylonian captivity in all likelihood, and they're saying, all right, we're here amongst Babylonian religion and all these multiplicity of gods. You know, how do we explain where we came from and why we're in this position that we're in? You know, our God Yahweh that we worship has allowed us to go into captivity. How do we explain this? And so you have an Exodus, a book of Exodus, understanding of the creation and generation of the ancient Israelites. But then you have a more cosmological idea presented in Genesis. And I just think if you understand it from a literary standpoint, just thinking of it as literature, God creates the universe. God deals with mankind in general. They screw up, which is an interesting, almost uniquely Old Testament theme, that it's the sin of mankind that brings about the flood, as opposed to, you know,
the gods being dicks.
Yeah. So God destroys them and then starts back over, and they screw up again with the Tower of Babel, and God decides he's going to spread them all out and pick one nation. Guess which one it is? You know, it's Israel. And so you see the patriarchs, you see them, you know, narrowing down. They've been given these covenants, they're given the land. And so then when you come to, you know, down through this period of the judges and through the monarchy and then the divided kingdoms in Israel, and you get to the Babylonian captivity after they've written all this history, now it's clear, we're here in captivity, not because Yahweh failed. It's because we failed.
We did something to deserve this.
Yeah.
It's not that our God is not powerful enough to protect us from the Babylonians. It's that he deliberately let us be captured.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure. So when you're reading the book of Genesis, it's supposed to be read literally, or is it supposed to be some sort of allegory? Or,
I mean, I would say it's mythology. Probably a good way to classify it would be etiological mythology. So it's trying to explain the origins, right? It's trying to explain how did we get here? How do we understand the things that we see now? I think we often try, and I'm monopolizing the conversation here. You should talk more. But, you know, when we consider how they interpreted these texts, how they understood these texts, I think that we try to see it from a 21st century perspective. And a good example of this, I think, is the very important and all-pervasive, I guess that's the word I want to use, Babylonian creation myth called the Enuma Elish, and Megan's been reading it in her Soothing Stories with Megan video series. But it's the story about the exaltation of the god Marduk, the Babylonian god Marduk. And in that text, you know, it shows his defeat of the sea god Tiamat, sea goddess Tiamat, and his creation of the universe. But that text was used. It was used annually. It was part of the New Year's festival, the New Year's ritual, and it was read every year to essentially reassert the dominance of the king of the god Marduk, who's the Babylonian god. And interestingly enough, when the Assyrians came and conquered Babylon and destroyed it because of a number of reasons. One of the things that they did is they took many of the literary and ritual texts back with them to Assyria. And that particular text was taken back and rewritten. Now, the god in Assyria was Asher. And what they did is they didn't change the story, except instead of writing Marduk, every time Marduk was written, they wrote Asher instead. They didn't change the story. You know, they didn't modify it. As a matter of fact, at the end of the tablet, there are 50 names of Marduk. There's a bunch of wordplay that's used, and they write out all these 50 different names of Marduk, different forms of praise of him. They replace each one with Asher. The problem is that all of those...
But the puns don't work anymore.
Yeah, they're all
rely on one name.
They're all wordplays on Marduk, so it just looks stupid, right? But that didn't matter.
But it doesn't matter.
Because what this means is that if Asher's name is put in that story, that now gives him the power. That is evidence that he is the one that did this. So this idea that that there's some sort of problem in their minds if they came up with this story of Yahweh creating the way that he did in Genesis 1, or a separate tradition of how he did it in Genesis 2, and they mash those two things together, that's some sort of problem for them in their interpretive framework is ridiculous. Because that wasn't a problem for them. That wasn't an issue.
I have a question. I have so many questions. So one of the things that struck me when I read Genesis first was that God put people on earth, and then, you know, you flip the page and then he makes them again, and then he makes Adam and Eve. Were there two separate texts? It looks almost like there's two separate texts just kind of jammed together, like two people got into a fight. No, mine is the one that goes in. And then somebody else said, mine's the one that goes in. And then somebody else came in and like, you know what? Both of you, you can both have it. We'll put them both in. Do you know a bit of the background of how the Bible was constructed? And could you
Sure. that? Sure. Actually, we're going to have someone on, Dr. William Reed, who he's just graduated from Johns Hopkins in Hebrew Bible. We'll have him on the channel to talk about the Deuteronomistic history, is what they call the it's part of this whole where did the Pentateuch come from, and where did the early books of the Old Testament come from. But you know, one of the things that scholars have wrestled with for however long they've been talking about the Hebrew Bible is this exact problem, right? These doublets that they call them in the Hebrew Bible, and they're not just in Genesis, of course. They're all throughout. And what I think the common consensus among the scholarly community that discusses and debates this is that you have multiple traditions that were going on contemporaneously. And I think that probably a good way to think about this is that during that exilic period, maybe even the post-exilic period, where you have Persian rule, I think that's probably a pretty good hypothesis, is that the Persian Empire, the king said, look, get your shit together, right? You have these different traditions, get it together. And so they edited this text together in a way that it wasn't an issue for them. This clear problem that we have, Genesis 1, this creation story, Genesis 2, a different creation story, right? Or even, I think even more stark is the flood account, where you have these two competing traditions, it seems like, or Genesis is a competing tradition with the Exodus myth for the origins of Israel. But, and then how they try to weave them together sort of superficially. But I think the thing to remember in all of this is that was not an issue for them. Them weaving together, first of all, it's exceptionally common in the ancient world. In our field of study, and Megan could probably talk about this ad nauseum, we have the Gilgamesh epic, for example, I think is a really good example of this. This is the nice thing about our field. We know this stuff to be true because we have the actual tablets, right? We have the cuneiform tablets from the early second millennium BCE. And then we have them from the first millennium.
So you have what might be termed the original stories. And then later on, you have those same stories kind of integrated together to form one epic narrative. So you can see the development of the different traditions being kind of melded into one thing. We don't have that for the Hebrew Bible because you just don't have those original sources. What you have is a much, much later version where everything's already been merged together. So unpicking where all the different stories came from is quite difficult.
And not only merged together, but then, you know, corrected and edited down throughout the centuries. I mean, it's like what we have with Sumerian and Akkadian texts, for example, with the Gilgamesh epic, if you're familiar with it. If you're not, if you're watching and you're not, we have a video, an interview that we did on the Non Sequitur show, where we went through the Gilgamesh epic. But the Gilgamesh epic is it's actually rather late, comparatively speaking, to the Gilgamesh stories, because the Gilgamesh stories circulated originally as Sumerian stories. So Gilgamesh and Huwawa is the story about him going to the cedar forest with Enkidu and killing Huwawa. That was a separate story. So anyway, these stories exist disparately. Thank you. And the we probably have an Akkadian epic already formulated in the Old Babylonian period in the second millennium, but definitely by the first millennium, even the late second millennium, you know, this this scribe is trying to say something theologically. He's trying to talk about the mortality of humankind and how people seek to gain immortality. And so he takes these separate stories, these individual stories, and he weaves them together to create this epic, right? And he blocks it off with an epilogue, prologue and an epilogue, to make it this unified whole. So we have this sort of editing that goes on, and we can see it very clearly in the ancient world. And I just think it's problematic that people, particularly people that are fundamentalist Christians, that want to see the Bible as not only the inerrant, inspired word of God, which I'm actually fine with if you want to see that, but not understanding the genre, the various genres of the Bible, and trying to make them say things that they were never intended to say.
It must really frustrate you guys watching some apologists that aren't even remotely a 1/1,000,000,000th as literate as you in the subject matter, just obliterating
the text. But it's honestly, it's the reason I promise I will stop talking. I promise. But it's the reason
I'll make for a very boring interview if you stop talking.
I was going to say, kind of thing, that's why we're here.
But I think this is the reason, this is initially the reason that I got on YouTube in the first place back in like March or April, whatever it was.
Those years ago.
Yeah. I was listening to Aaron Rod debate somebody, and it probably was somebody very elite and scholarly like Kent Hovind. And,
yeah, exactly. Adequate
description. But I remember just, you know, whoever he was debating was talking about the Old Testament, talking about the Hebrew. And I just remember, you know, thinking, oh, Aaron, I wish I could text you or something and say, here's what to say. So I emailed him, and then I ended up emailing the Non Sequitur show. And of course, Kyle and Steve had me on, and this is the sort of stuff we talked about. And then of course they met Megan, and they were far more interested in Megan. And as everyone is.
That is not true.
If you want to know why we have 1,000 subscribers,
So that's how you guys got into the YouTube channel? You emailed the Non Sequitur show and Aaron after watching that debate. Had you ever intended on having a YouTube channel? Did it just snowball from there?
Even when Joshua went on the Non Sequitur show for that first time, I just sat in the chat and talked to people. And like three different people asked, does this guy have his own YouTube channel? I really want to learn more about this. I can't remember what you were talking about. It was Babylonian history
I think it was just
mythology or just general
history, yeah.
Mesopotamia. And I said, he doesn't, but that's actually a really, really good idea. Because after Josh graduated, for varying reasons, he couldn't get a job. Decided not to get a job in academia. Which was quite sad for us both. I mean, I'm still a student, so I get my daily dose of writing and research, but he didn't have that anymore. And this seemed like a really good way to kind of satisfy his intellectual needs and also provide something that people might be interested in. So afterwards, I mentioned to him, so Well, actually, no, I think Steve had been watching the chat and he said, so I hear you're going to start your own YouTube channel. And Josh's face was just an absolute picture because I hadn't told him yet.
Well, I didn't know there was such a thing as a YouTube channel. Like, I didn't realize that's what I was, you know, been watching all this time, people's YouTube channels. Like, what is that?
So then that's adorable.
Yeah. Oh, Josh, you're such a moron. No, it's true.
So we started one that next week, I think.
Yeah.
And we both love it. It's so much fun.
It's gone through some developments over the years, over the months. It used to be me sitting like this in front of the camera, like, you know, talking about goofy shit. But
it's what I do every video. I just, there you go. You just can't see me. We have a super chat from Wellington Smith who asks, anyone here have any resources about the universal inconsistencies in the old tales, Torah, Greco-Roman, Mesopotamia, any with internal consistency? Is there like some kind of, if somebody had to read one book about that, what would you recommend?
About all of that?
In one book.
I think maybe the inconsistencies maybe about the Bible or inconsistencies in the Old Testament, maybe.
I mean... So this actually, we had an email today sort of about this. Somebody was asking me in somewhat of a challenging way, you know, point out some historical problems, you know, some historical issues.
My response was, you know, Google exists, right?
But
like just Google problems with the Bible.
But I mean,
you will find some.
I think I understand what they're asking, but I want to answer in a slightly different way, kind of going back to this issue of genre. You know, we consider things to be historical issues when we think that the text is supposed to be historiography, right? So when we read about Abraham in Genesis 17 or in Genesis 14, for example, fighting against these four kings from the east, and we try to figure out who is Amraphel, right? Who is this king? That's over, you know, one of the kings from the east, you know, that's making the assumption that this was supposed to be historically accurate, right? Or when we look at the Exodus, something maybe that's a little more universal to people, we look at the Exodus and we try to determine, all right, where did those 2.5 million people come out of Egypt? Where did they cross? You know, and you see documentaries about, you know, the Red Sea and where there's a landmass that's a little higher under the water. And this is where Moses must have gone across. It's putting the cart before the horse here, right? It's assuming that this text was written to say there really was an actual Exodus, that was an intent. And so then, of course, if it is meant to be that way, then you can say, all right, well, here are the historical inaccuracies, right? But I don't know that I would start there. I think that I would start with what is this text doing? What is it trying to do? And in stories like that, I think if you can look at particularly these earlier books and say that they're doing something theological more than they're doing something historiographical, then see, this is why she keeps going.
keeps you on track.
Right. Now, things that I would say, so all that being said, I mean, there are a lot of good introductory Old Testament. If your real focus is on the Old Testament, there are lots of Old Testament, like introductions to the Old Testament. I mean, I'd have to go back and look. I think from a maybe broader sense, focusing on Mesopotamia, which is what we do, I'm summarizing A. Leo Oppenheim's book from like the mid-70s, late-70s, called Mesopotamia, Ancient Mesopotamia, A Portrait of a Dead Civilization. And in that, I'm doing that in a series on our Daily Data on our YouTube channel. And that sort of brings in the wider Near East as it introduces the three millennia of Mesopotamian history. So maybe that's a good place to start. But if you guys want to email me, whoever asked that, digitalhammurabi@gmail.com, you know, and specifically ask what you're looking for, I can definitely provide some resources depending on where they want to go with it.
I think one of the problems that crops up a lot with people in the historicity of the Bible is because there are a couple of events that seem to be historically accurate, and I'm not talking about a lot, but there are probably a couple, people latch onto those, say, look, there's evidence for this actually happening outside of the Bible. That means the rest of it has to be true as well.
I mean, they're sorry.
No, go for it.
I mean, they're like definitely when you get into the Kings and the later Chronicles, right? I mean, we know that the Assyrians came in. We know that the House of Omri existed. We have monuments that show Omri bowing down. I mean, we know these things happened, right? But these are, and I think that's what you're referring to, you know? So for example, the book of Ezekiel, book of Ezekiel is a wonderful example of this for a number of reasons. Because Ezekiel is, I mean, he's writing about events that he sees happening.
He was also high.
Probably.
Someone is tripping on something.
But the reason that it's so amazing is that there are prophecies. For example, if you go to Ezekiel 26, you'll see the prophecy about the city of Tyre, right? And Ezekiel says, oh, Tyre, he sees Nebuchadnezzar coming, right? And Nebuchadnezzar's coming across and he's laying siege to Tyre. He destroys the city, the pasture lands, whatever you want to call them. So Tyre was a city that was an island city. So there's, water in between the secondary city, whatever you want to call it, and the actual city of Tyre during this period. Of course, after Alexander created that causeway out there, it's now grown into a peninsula going out. But, before that, it was an island city. And so he sees him, destroying the outer part on the land, on the mainland, and he's laying siege to Tyre. And whoa, Tyre! You're going to be
definitely going to be destroyed,
not just destroyed, like wiped clean, bare rock. Everything's going to be thrown into the sea. You'll never be rebuilt again. And then two chapters later, you could almost picture Ezekiel. It's 14 years later, two chapters later.
Tyre is still there.
Tyre's still there. Nebuchadnezzar clearly did not take it. Right. And so he has to sort of give a new prophecy. So he says, Nebuchadnezzar, every shoulder was rubbed bare, every head was rubbed bald, by laying siege to this. But God did not allow him to take Tyre. He's going to give him Egypt instead as plunder because Nebuchadnezzar was turning to Egypt.
Nope.
Well, that prophecy failed, even though Ezekiel didn't live to see it because Nebuchadnezzar never took Egypt. But you can see that these are events that took place, right? And I think this is what Megan's referring to. These sorts of events took place. But that doesn't mean that when the text says Yahweh sent his angel through the camp and killed 200,000 soldiers, that part, is a historical reality. So
it's kind of like historical fiction then. Like parts of it are true, parts of it aren't.
That's a pretty good way of describing it, actually. Mm-hmm.
It's taking history, writing it from a theological perspective, trying to make a theological argument, and then interpreting the events in a way that you believe they took place. So a good example of this today would be, I've mentioned this in a couple of different videos that we've done, but I've been interacting with a group called the Congregation of Lord Rael. And
goodness, I know who they are.
You know who they are. Good. Yes. If your audience doesn't, this is a group that believes that there was a guy out in Chicago named Raymond Elwood. And on January 28th, 2011, the spirit of Jesus, they wouldn't call it that, but the spirit of Jesus descended over Jerusalem and then came over to America and came upon Raymond Elwood, and he became Lord Rael. So he's like Jesus revivified. Of course, they mesh Christian doctrine with ancient Sumerian religion and Mesopotamian religion. So they believe that he's also the god Enlil revivified. But anyway, but the point is that they're giving these predictions, right? And they're interpreting these events that take place in modern times. And they're saying this is Lord Rael bringing judgment. So, for example, when the hurricane came through and hit North Carolina, they said that's Lord Rael bringing the hurricane. Well, that's a historical event, right? I mean, we
know it happened.
We know it happened, but we know that it wasn't Lord Rael that did it, right? Right.
And in the can we know that? This is true. Really, is true. Josh, is that true. Is quite the assertion.
How dare you defame Lord Rael's wishes?
Megan's like inching away from me as lightning's about to strike.
Actually, Josh has been trying to arrange a discussion with them on the Non Sequitur show. And one of the reasons they've given so far for refusing is because they don't want Josh to be struck down by Lord Rael for his blasphemous ways, which is very nice of them, actually, because I am very fond of my husband. I would prefer for him not to be struck by lightning.
But this is the thing that I think is so frustrating, and I promise I will stop talking about this. But, I really feel like from a scholarly perspective, you know, Megan sort of said that in jest. We don't know that it's not Lord Rael. But
we don't really. I don't think it was.
Because of that, I want people to know this because there are a lot of people that accuse me of being like anti-Christian, right? Of course, I was a Christian for 30 years, a fundamentalist evangelical for 30 years. And so I have no angst. I mean, not angst. I have no anger or animosity against Christianity. I learned things, right? And I guess what I'm saying is that I want people to know that I honestly engage with the evidence, and Megan honestly engages with the evidence. And so, you know, when I interacted with them, I said, look, convince me, right? Present your case. I have not been moved by what I consider to be paucity of evidence that they've given me. I would love for them to come on and give me more. If anybody's watching and is part of this congregation, please, you know, email me and come on and let's talk. But they have yet to agree to do that. So
I want to talk to you about the idea of whether Jesus existed or not. But first, I wanted to hear about your why did you change from being an evangelical to, or are you still Christian or?
No, I wouldn't say that I am. So, of course, I was raised, by the way, this is Thomas.
Hi, Thomas. I like Thomas. He's adorable.
In the true manner of all cats, he's cottoned on to the one person in this household that does not like cats and has made him his favorite human in the whole world.
Yeah.
The one on the bed's chilling, too.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
That looks very comfortable.
If you put kittens in the description of this video, it'll probably get a lot of hits. Not that you guys have problems with that, but you know, I was raised in a very conservative household, and you know, my parents were Christians, my grandparents are Christians, my grandfather essentially raised me in the Christian faith, and you know, we went to Baptist churches for most of my childhood. And, you know, I went to Liberty University, if that means anything to you, and got my bachelor's degree in religion. And so I went to an evangelical, conservative seminary called Capital Bible Seminary. And, you know, so my master's thesis, I wrote on the divine name El Shaddai, the Hebrew divine name El Shaddai, and it's 48 occurrences in the Hebrew Bible and what it means. Sorry, this is probably terribly boring.
I'm just waiting for you to tell them about your presuppositions in your thesis.
Oh yeah. So that you know, the first paragraph or the first several paragraphs of the thesis was, it is presupposed in this thesis that Moses wrote the five books of the Pentateuch. I mean, there you go.
Fact.
I mean, like, so Moses existed and he wrote all five of these books, which course is nonsense in my opinion, but at that point that was, of course, I mean, of course he did, who else would have done it? So when I went to Hopkins, I had a conversation with someone on the staff at the seminary, and they said, are you ready to go into the lion's den? Because see, I was, you know, I had majored in I have a THM in Old Testament studies, so I'd taken 6 years of Hebrew, I'd taken Aramaic, I'd taken Syriac and Akkadian and blah, blah, blah. I loved linguistics. And so I applied to go to Hopkins as an Assyriologist to learn Akkadian and Sumerian, because that was considered to be the high road in our field. I was going to be the best damn Old Testament scholar for the name of Jesus that anybody had ever seen.
He's going to convert all of Hopkins as well.
And that was what I said to them. I'm going into the lion's den, but I'm gonna bring them to Christ, you know. And then I got there, and my first semester, there was a very good friend of mine, Dr. Knapp, Andrew Knapp, who is an amazing man. And I remember he was a Hebrew Bible, majored in Hebrew Bible. And he said to me, so you're an evangelical Christian? I said, yeah. And he said, I'll be watching. Because, you know, each of us had to take a 3-year cycle of history. For example, the first year was Syro-Palestinian history, and we had to take Mesopotamian history and Egyptian history, a full year of each. And I remember just going through, and about halfway through the first semester, I just went, I mean, like, this is all bullshit. I mean, like, the Pentateuch, like, this history is just, what? I mean, what is this? Like, this shit didn't happen, right? And so I thought, well, if this didn't happen, I understood the genre of the Old Testament. I mean, the genre of the Pentateuch, particularly of Genesis, to be historiography, right? In the way that we see it in 21st century America. And so if that wasn't true, that means all of the Bible is just complete bullshit. I became an atheist almost instantly. Somebody asked me in a stream, how long did that take? And I said, about an hour and a half.
Wow.
And that's the reality.
Because the problem is, if you hinge your belief on the historicity of the Bible, and then you find out that this little part of the Bible actually is not historically accurate, everything crumbles.
Everything.
Once you learn that and once you believe it, there's not a whole bunch you can do, I don't think.
And this is why people like Cy Ten Bruggenkaet, of whom I am not a great fan, when you say things to him, like, well, what do you do with this historically erroneous part? If you understand, for example, Genesis 1 to be literal scientific historiography, how do you deal with this problem scientifically? And if his response is not, I don't have Bible studies with atheists, which I think is a terrible cop out. If you can get him to actually engage with it, his response will be, I don't understand it, but I know that it's true. And once I do understand it, it will be true and accurate. And that's a wonderful piece of cognitive dissonance, in my opinion. It's a way of sort of copping out cognitively, saying it all has to be true 100%, because that's who God is and that's how God would write. And so if you have to face the data and you have to say, the shit that I knew about the Philistines just isn't true, for example, it's like, well, if that's not true and I know it, like I can see it, it all falls apart like that. So
if you, I know Shannon's got a bunch of questions. So after this question, I will shut up and let Shannon.
No, go ahead. I'm good.
But so if you fast forward to Jesus, or the era of Jesus, some people argue that Jesus never existed. It's not an argument that I really care about too much, but I do find it kind of interesting. Do you think that Jesus is an actual historical figure, or that he just never existed and it's just kind of a myth that's been built up?
Yeah, I mean, so I always like to preface these when the conversation goes this way. I always like to preface things in a way that I am really sorry. I feel like I'm the only one talking. This is sorry.
Funny, you're the biblicist. Go for it.
Sorry. You know, I have a master's. I took Greek for, I think, 7 years. I've read almost all of the New Testament in its original language. So, I mean, I feel like I'm qualified to talk to a certain extent about New Testament issues. That being said, I don't have my PhD in it. As a matter of fact, I don't have my PhD. My major in my PhD was not Hebrew Bible. So when things get into, really controversial topics that I don't feel like, I feel like other people are should be commenting on instead of me. I'll qualify that in. You know, somebody like Richard Carrier is obviously far more researched in this type of mythicism. And of course, I would defer to people like him or to Bart Ehrman, those sorts of people. That being said, I guess I'm sort of with you. It's not terribly important to me whether there was an actual guy named Jesus, in the same sense that I don't really care too terribly much whether a guy named Gilgamesh existed. And we have pretty decent evidence, I think, that Gilgamesh existed. And he was a king of Uruk in the third millennium, but it's not
the point.
It's not terribly relevant to how we understand either history or the texts that are written about him, right? Because these are texts of legend. Now, I think that there's a lot to be said about Jesus not being a historical person, just, you know, from the research that I've done. But again, I'm not what I would consider to be. I'm definitely not an expert in that. But what I would say is, given what we know about the way the New Testament was formed and the understanding of the time from both a religious perspective and from even just an understanding of how history was formulated at the time, It wasn't, in my opinion, necessary for there to be a historical Jesus in order for the, obviously, for the religion to go the direction that it did, because that wouldn't have been, I don't think that would have been a necessity, because in the same way that, let's just say for the sake of argument that a guy named Jesus existed, he didn't have to do miraculous things in order for this legend to build up around him, in the same way that Gilgamesh didn't need to do these miraculous things that he is said to have done, like going and killing a divine being out in the cedar forest, or having his buddy descend into the netherworld and come back up. Like, these things didn't need to happen. He didn't need to be two-thirds divine in order for these legends to build up. And we know that because these legends built up. I would say at the end of the day, I don't know. And I would defer to people that, that have done the research in this particular field, to a greater extent than I have, but I guess I'm with you. I don't see it as in any way being a necessity, or that it's, I don't know. It's a good video to put up to get hits, I guess, you know, to talk about whether Jesus was a myth or not, but I don't know that it's terribly relevant in the end.
Yeah, it's what I look at it the kind of the same way. Even if, let's just grant that he did exist, I'm certain that he wasn't resurrected, and I'm certain that he didn't perform miracles. Somebody could have existed that garnered a following, and then he could have been, an archetype could have been built around him because he was idolized, and then, you know.
It's how legends work.
Yeah, exactly. He became a legend because people kind of utilized him to continue the narrative that they wanted to
he wouldn't have been the first or the last person to.
That's exactly right. God, right?
Yeah, there's Rael.
That's right. I mean, think about it, Rael.
Happening now.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, okay. 20 years from now, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, if something happens to him, I mean, I think it would be extraordinarily easy for that congregation to really build up a religion. I mean, of course, they've built it up already, and he's around. It's not an issue. And even though we're far more critical today, given our,
well, some people believe the Earth is flat, so I wouldn't say more
on measure, on balance.
I would say some people try to be more critical.
I stand corrected.
Some people are morons.
Yeah.
That's fair too.
See why you like her.
All right, am I allowed to ask questions now? Are you
go ahead, Shannon. I'm sorry, I kind of monopolized the whole interview.
No, that's totally fine. Awesome. Okay, so I have a question for Megan, actually.
Yes.
So, Megan, what's your particular specialty? I know that Josh did like the Bible, but is your specialty more so Assyrian? And
yes, so I did, my undergraduate degree was in ancient history, and I did Greek, Roman, Mesopotamia, and Egypt for 3 years. Then I did a master's in Near Eastern studies, which is Mesopotamia. And then my PhD is the same field as Josh, but I focus on a slightly different area. Instead of being really a linguist, I can do the linguistics, but I find it more difficult than he does, because he can, well, it's like breathing for him, and it's more like swimming around the world for me.
But I can't do in any way the way the stuff that she does.
Well, I'm, my dissertation is on the royal inscriptions of Mesopotamia, which are pretty ubiquitous. There are inscriptions from all kings, all time periods, all geographical locations, on all kinds of different objects. So you've got them on bricks, on foundation deposits, on vessels, and even beads. You get tiny beads with king names written on them. And because there are so many of them, they've never been studied as a whole corpus before. People either take a particular time period or a particular king, or they look at, say, inscribed statues through the ages. So what I've done is I've made a very large database of inscriptions and objects from the early dynastic, which is like 3000 BC, through till the Old Babylonian, which is about 2500 BC.
Do you want to take a second, mm-hmm. and maybe just like 2 minutes, explain like Assyriology a little bit? Because I don't know that, I mean, maybe everybody listening knows exactly what we're talking about, but like if we were doing Egyptology, maybe like a... Do you want to do that?
Sure.
No pressure.
Megan, define your whole field in 2 minutes. It very basically, it's the languages and cultures of ancient Iraq, modern Iraq, ancient Mesopotamia. Looking at all of the different kingdoms and empires that kind of rose and fell in that region. And it's a long period of history. It's about 4,000 years.
So she's doing these Sumerian and Akkadian mm-hmm. royal inscriptions. So
yeah, but the history goes from like the founding of the first city, which for Mesopotamia is the city of Ur.
Uruk.
Oh, thank you, there Uruk. You it's not late.
We've been drinking.
So the city of Uruk all the way through till kind of when Alexander the Great conquers Babylon. Except that I don't like the conquering of Babylon is pretty late for me. And actually for a lot of Assyriologists, once you get past the Neo-Assyrian Empire, once you're into the Persian stuff,
you're like,
it's like, not so interesting. I'm going to be shot now for saying that.
Yeah, we apologize.
We do apologize. It is interesting. It's just not my thing. So one of the things that ancient kings do is they write inscriptions all the time because they want everyone to know how amazing they are. It's also a key way that they communicated with their gods. A lot of these inscriptions are built into the walls and foundations of temples. So one of the interesting topics with a lot of the inscriptions is who was the intended audience, because they're not freely available for the general public to read. So it's not like they're propaganda trying to convince subjected people. Subjected, that's not the word I'm looking for, is it? Subjugated. Trying to convince subjugated people that this is the way things should be, and you should just be happy that you have such a nice king.
I mean, they get that from the size of the temples and
from other things. But because they're built into temples, it's thought that they were intended for both the eyes of the gods and also for future kings, because you quite regularly have later kings digging up temples to restore them, finding these old inscriptions, reburying them with their own foundation inscription, saying, I so-and-so dug up this old inscription to renovate the temple, and because I'm such a great king, I'm placing the original inscription back in the foundation with my own inscription because I'm good and pious, and if someone else finds my inscription in the future, please treat it with care and restore it to its place when you finish the renovations.
And this is, sorry to jump up, but this is, if you read the Gilgamesh epic, for those of you watching that have done so, you know, it opens with open the tablet box, you know, read the tablet of lapis lazuli. This is exactly what he's doing. And the story begins and ends with that. This is the way that not only communicated with the gods or communicated with future kings, both to warn them and to educate them, whatever, but it gives you this immortality, right? Because your name continues on.
Your name lives on. And I mean, the people who were digging, well, the kings, the later kings who were digging this stuff up, would like several hundred years later, long after the names of these kings had actually been forgotten because their dynasties had fallen and their families were no longer in control, their stuff was still being dug up. Their names were still being read and remembered, which was very, very important for ancient Mesopotamia, partly because the underworld, the afterlife, was such a miserable place. It's not like the modern Christian conception of hell.
By the way, that Prophet of Zod video, I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Oh, I love him.
But where the kid and the father die. And
yeah.
Man, I almost cried watching that thing. I'm sure he didn't intend it that way, but damn.
He may have.
Yeah, maybe he did. Okay, sorry.
He's playing 4D chess.
So the Mesopotamian afterlife was pretty different. It was kind of miserable and dark and dusty. And the one way that you could make it better for yourself was by having lots and lots of children so they'd remember your name and give you food offerings. So by burying these foundation tablets and making sure that future kings found them and remembered them, they were kind of preserving their own future when they died. I got off track. So yeah, what I'm doing for my dissertation is looking at the inscriptions and looking at the objects they were placed on and trying to find correlations between what kind of inscription is placed on what kind of object, what they were used for, if there was a difference between inscriptions, like the use of inscriptions put on foundation tablets and inscriptions put on vessels, and kind of tracking the changes throughout time. Because I'm looking at nearly 2,000 years of history. So while these objects keep being made and the inscriptions keep being written, they do change and you get kind of similarities between one dynasty and another, and then someone else is completely different. I find it interesting. But I look more at less at the linguistics and more at the history and the beliefs and practices of the people.
So it's useful.
Well,
it's interesting. It's fascinating. Like I'm really I love your guys' live streams. I'm always watching your live streams. You guys are so interactive. Everybody needs to go subscribe to you. You're like my favorite new channel by far, like leaps and bounds. I was so excited when you said you would come on because you know your stuff so much. Like I'm envious of how knowledgeable you are in. I mean, I operate kind of in the same area, but I couldn't even touch on your knowledge base if I tried.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why we're doing this, because it's not like there's a freely available list of books that you should read if you want to know about Mesopotamia. There's very little popular literature out there. What there is, half of it is by Zachariah Sitchin.
Your bestie.
Oh, yes. It's not recommended unless you really enjoy science fiction. And even then, go and find better science fiction. Sorry, I do enjoy science fiction, and reading that book was very uncomfortable for me.
It makes me want to weep and then die.
Don't die. It's okay to cry, just don't die.
We had one more question in the chat. And thank you, Rolambo, for the super chat. He asked, is DH saying that the burial tablets were libraries? Did they use them as such, or were they backup to their libraries?
They were completely different to libraries. There are libraries in the ancient world. There are text archives. Private individuals kept archives of personal letters, business transactions. If you were a scribal family, you probably had literary texts as well. There's the very famous library of Ashurbanipal from the Near Assyrian period, which is just a huge collection of all kinds of tablets. The foundation inscriptions are more things like, they're much shorter, they're this big, and they generally say things like, I, Ornamu, great king of Babylon, well, king of Sumer, I built this temple for the goddess Inanna. Occasionally you'll get like a request for a long life, maybe a prayer at the end. but there, or maybe like a record of some kind of military victory. But the foundation inscriptions are very short, they're very terse, and they're kind of like bragging rights. It's kind of like a king saying, look at what I did. Isn't it amazing?
I drive a big truck.
I drive a massive truck. you should bless me and let me be king forever and ever and ever. Amen.
So it was just like the ancient dick measuring contest.
I knew penises were going to come into
this. They always do, honey. It's inevitable. Although they're kind of like the, you know, when someone endows a building for a university or for a government. And there's that stone on the side that says endowed by the Bowen family. Yeah. It's kind of like that, just not intended for the public to view it, intended for the gods to view it. So it's hidden.
For the gods to view it. That's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And especially like, I don't know how you two come together. Did you two come together after you had deconverted Josh? Because like her studying all of this ancient history, like all of these religions that happened, you know, before, you know, the earth existed, this flat earth was existed.
We met in grad school, actually. So we were both, I'm in the program at the same place Josh just graduated from, and we overlapped by several years. He actually taught me Akkadian and Sumerian for a year.
Okay.
This is how I got her, right? She fell in love with her professor. So.
Fair enough. All right. Do you have any more questions, Juicy? I've monopolized enough. Or does the chat have any more questions? Because we're getting close to the end. We've only got about 5 minutes.
Yeah. No, you go ahead. I monopolize most of the time. So
okay.
Get in your questions.
Okay. I'm trying to be fair. But the chat might have had questions. Okay. So this is probably going to be the last question that I have. And I'm going to make it about your channel so that you guys can promote yourself. Why don't you tell us about your brand new website, please?
Thank you. It's really exciting. I've been kind of tinkering with it for a while now.
If you want to look at it while we're doing this, right. It's digitalhammurabi.com. Come on, somebody.
Very catchy title. It just provides a bit more information about who we are. There's a great page about why you should listen to us, because so many times I feel people on the internet say, I have an opinion, you should listen to it and believe me, without providing any kind of backup for, well, really, why should I listen to you? Yeah. The analogy I used on our last live stream was, are you some teenager from Utah writing about astrophysics on Wikipedia, or are you an astrophysics professor at Harvard? Those two kind of carry very different weights.
Yeah. And sometimes astrophysics professors write about Old Testament stuff, and right, they shouldn't be doing that.
Which is also a big problem. We have a video about that.
Yeah.
So the website's just kind of intended to give people a non-YouTube place to go, because YouTube doesn't give you a lot of space to write about who you are. So it's just an expanded version. We've got a nice, who we are, and also information about our summer scholarship program. We're raising money at the moment to provide summer funding for a PhD student. I describe it as America's Got Talent for academics, less singing, hopefully more really good scholarly research.
And if I could,
yeah.
So this is really, when we started this thing and we found out that like you get money for doing it, which was a surprise, we decided that what we were gonna do is, we got a Patreon account, and of course we're not monetized or anything yet, because I don't think we've had 4,000 hours.
No, we're close to the 4,000 hours.
But what we do is, of course I teach a Sumerian grammar class. All those videos are up on the new website. Of course they're up on the YouTube channel as well, but I teach a Sumerian grammar class. I just put up a new video today. I'll be teaching Akkadian grammar here shortly, and then I'll teach Hebrew. But you know, we do that all for free because I like doing it, and I want people to be able to have this information and to do some research themselves. But what we decided we want to do is, any money that came in on this Patreon and any money that comes in like, I guess that's how we get money now, is through Patreon. I got a Fulbright scholarship to go to Germany when I was at Hopkins, and it was really nice because, you know, I got another year of funding and I was able to travel. But in our field, it's very difficult to have money because
we're not fixing cancer.
Yeah.
We're not, the value of what we do is very difficult to explain. And at times I wonder why the hell I'm doing it. So convincing other people that you should be getting money for studying this really weird esoteric ancient stuff is difficult. So there isn't the same level of funding that you get if you go into medicine or the STEM fields. And if you're a humanities student, you're lucky if you get five years of funding. And our program typically takes 9 years of study full time.
And what makes it worse, worse isn't the right word, but more difficult, is that you often have to travel abroad to do research projects. So, for example,
you have to go on archaeological digs, or you have to go to different museums because this material is scattered all over the world.
My professor almost every summer travels back to Germany because there are so many tablets over there, or to France. He's got to look at these collections. Well, that costs a fair amount of money. So what we decided we wanted to do is...
I should add here, we chose to do this, right? I knew that I wouldn't be making a lot of money in my chosen field. And that was my choice. And all of the PhD students coming mm-hmm. after me have made exactly the same choice. So we're not saying that they deserve more money just because. Sure. We're saying that we're in a position now to help. Yeah. And we really want to help. And based on the response we've had from our viewers, other people want to help too. So what we're trying to do is just provide kind of like a central point for all those people who have an extra $10 maybe to pull together and to help a grad student who can't afford their education and also can't afford to take time out to work. Because if you take time out to work, that's time you're not studying, which just extends the whole PhD process.
But there's a tremendous benefit to all of the viewers, particularly the Patreons, because basically when she says it's like America's Got Talent, it's like if you apply for the Fulbright scholarship, they're all students are looking for scholarships. They're trying to get one. So what we wanted to do was offer between $2,500 and $3,000 for a summer research project. And what these students will do, PhD students will do, is they'll submit research project proposals to us. And the two of us will sit down and, you know, weed them out. Figure out who's doing real research and who's not.
No aliens.
But we'll narrow it down to maybe 5 or 10 packages that are good, that are all good from different ancient Near Eastern fields. And then we will invite each of these candidates on to do an interview, like I guess what we're doing here, and to present their project and to sort of, you know, pitch to the audience.
So then the audience, especially our Patreons, get to vote on who they think their money should be funding for that summer.
And then we'll give them the money and then, you know, all but maybe 10% of it or something. And they'll go off, do their research project. And when they come back, they'll come back and give another interview and
like
present.
A debrief.
Yeah. And then we'll, after they do that, then we'll give them the remaining 10% deposit. No,
somebody said in the chat that you're only 200 hours away from getting monetization. So
nice.
People that are watching this,
that's
maybe go check out their stuff and give them some.
Go binge. Go binge, guys. Go binge. Let's get them monetized.
I highly recommend our last live stream, which was our 1000 celebratory live stream, because it includes Sitchin, us telling you why Sitchin is full of crap because he doesn't read Sumerian, and also a very tasteful display of hats.
And lots of penis talk.
Lots of penis.
There was so much penis.
So much penis. And Josh and I trying on my collection of hats.
And we told everybody that they were asking in the live chat, what are you going to do when you hit 2,000 subscribers? And Megan said, Joshua, wear a dress.
So we're going to go to Goodwill and find him an evening gown.
An evening gown.
Because he won't fit into any of my dresses. Because he's.
Well, I learned on Twitter today that Shannon swims in YouTube money, so.
I do. Yeah, I just roll around in it. That's all I do.
Like Scrooge McDuck.
That's right.
It's one of the things that I think is really funny about Bionic Dance at the end of some of her videos. That's what she's doing, is the Scrooge McDuck thing. She's got an animation where she bounces off a diving board and dives into a bunch of cash and it says, join Patreon and add to the pile or something.
She's got a nice sense of humor for sure.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
I'll have to have you on again at some point.
Sounds great.
Thank you for watching, everyone.
And goodbye, chat.
Goodbye.